Blog Talk Radio.
Says it's June, but I don't know about you, but to me it feels like it's late October. I have a blanket wrapped around myself, so maybe it's best that me and you just stay inside and talk about books. Today is Monday, June 1st. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and tonight's Literary New England radio show features fun and thought-provoking book talk with the authors of three of today's hottest novels. Tonight, I talk with Megan Abbott about her latest, The Fever, which last month was re-released as a paperback and is in the process of being adapted into an MTV series by Sarah Jessica Parker's production company. A paperback release often feels like the rebirth of a book, and for Megan, it's brought about a whole new rush of excitement as accolades for The Fever continue.
We have a different cover for the paperback, which doesn't always happen, which is kind of striking. And so there's an element of it that feels new, and the TV news is just broken. So it feels like there's definitely I definitely feel a flurry of energy about it, which is kind of great.
Also here is Laura Vandenberg, who lives in the Boston area and is the author of the critically recognized Find Me, a dystopian novel set in Boston that tells a gripping, imaginative, and darkly funny tale of a young woman named Joy who's struggling to find her place in the world. Joy has no one. She spends her days working the graveyard shift at a grocery store and nursing an addiction to cough syrup. But when a sickness that begins with memory loss and ends with death sweeps the country, Joy, for the first time in her life, seems to have an advantage. She's immune. Find Me has been compared to Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, among other dystopian works. A compliment, for sure. But one of the things Laura likes so much about science fiction and fantasy is its scope.
That's the really interesting thing about just the dystopian landscape in general, that there's so many different shapes that can take. You know, Ben Marcus's The Flame Alphabet and Cormac McCarthy's The Road, but again, those are such radically different books.
We'll start things off talking with Cynthia Swanson about The Bookseller, the debut novel that Cynthia, a mother of three and full-time designer, drafted in chunks.
I just found these little pockets, and I would write sometimes for only 15 minutes a day, but I wrote every single day, and I got a first draft done before my older kids were done with school for the year.
The Bookseller has quickly become a book club favorite, and you can win yourself a copy right now by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com.
I think The Bookseller is about choices. It's about the fact that your life can change very quickly based on choices that you make, and they can sometimes be very simple ones or sometimes be what you think are more all-encompassing ones, like, you know, moving across the country or where to go to college or what job to take. I mean, obviously, those are big, huge choices, and we all face those. But then smaller things can also change your life on a dime, as happens to the character in this book, and that she makes a very small decision that ends up completely changing the course of her life. So I think it's kind of that exploration of the road not taken and how that could have happened to any of us.
So tell us about your protagonist. Tell us about Kitty Miller.
Well, she's 38 years old. It's 1962, and she has never been married. She owns a bookstore with her best friend, who's named Frieda Green, and they have a fairly peaceful life running their bookstore. They each live in their own little places. Kitty lives with her cat, who's named after the lion in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And so she has a very pleasant life running the bookstore with Frieda. She's very close to her parents. and mostly things are going pretty well. They're a little bit concerned about lack of business because their more commercial downtown neighborhood is now becoming less so. In the early 60s, people are starting to shop more in the suburbs and drive out to shopping malls. So that's kind of the one big concern. But other than that, things are fine. And then Kitty starts dreaming that she's got a completely different life. And in this life, she goes by her given name, which is Catherine, and she's married to a man named Lars Anderson, who's an architect. They have children. They have a big fancy house in the suburbs. And so she has a completely different life, and she doesn't have the bookstore anymore, and she and Frieda are no longer speaking, and she has no idea why. So, and she does a little bit of research in her Kitty life, and she finds that, but for one of those very small, minor details, minor changes of something that you might have done, her life as Catherine actually would have been her life. So it's the exploration of those different paths that a person could have taken.
So where did you get the story idea?
Well, it's certainly not an autobiographical story by any means, but it was inspired by me just one day. I was at the gym. I was on the Stairmaster, and I was pounding away and doing my workout, and it was 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. I had one little kid in the childcare area there at the Y, and two others were in school. And all of a sudden, I just had this moment where I'm like, wait a minute, is this my life? What happened to the life I used to have? Like the character, at one point I lived alone. I had a dog and a cat. It was just me and the dog and the cat. And I had a successful freelance writing career, and I made my own hours, and I did some creative writing on the side, and I did what I wanted. And then I met my husband to be, and we got married fairly quickly and had three kids fairly quickly. And it's just one of those things where life changed really, really suddenly. So I started thinking about a character who might sometimes wonder, wait a minute, which is my life? How did I end up in this life instead of that life so quickly and so randomly? So it's a little bit, it's certainly not an autobiographical story, but that seed of that idea just came out of that moment where I was just sort of thinking about my own life for a minute and thinking, wait a minute, is this real? And then you go back, and of course you're like, yeah, okay, it's real.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have had moments like that.
Absolutely.
Did you see the Broadway musical, If Then?
No, I haven't, but it's the same sort of idea, right?
Yes, with Idina Menzel, it's exactly the same sort of idea.
I think there are a lot of ideas like that. Obviously, the bookseller gets compared to Sliding Doors a lot, the movie with Gwyneth Paltrow from 15 years ago or so, where she, you know, the character either gets on the subway or doesn't, and then it completely changes the course of her life. So it's sort of that same idea of, and I mean, you can think about those in your own life, and none of us get to experience that the way that you do in a play or a movie or a book, but it's fun to think about, and I do think about those things sometimes, not, you know, all the different things that could have happened.
Well, I don't think that the theme is one that gets old, because it's one that we are constantly, I think, exploring, right? How many of us are always questioning, you know, the decisions that we made, and what if I did this, and what if I didn't do that? And then we see in our lives these miraculous and often horrendous things that just happen unexpectedly in a split second.
Right. And then, but to be on a more hopeful note about it, I think what hopefully most of us get to, and sort of the point in the book, is that some of those things just happen. They aren't, it's not like deciding to go to a particular college or move across the country. It's not a very conscious decision. It's just life changes on a dime, and there's just little things that happen. And something I say to my kids all the time is, you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. And it's kind of about that, is that you need to find contentment with, you can't go back to those little random moments. You can't change those. So there's no point in fretting about them. And that's kind of where hopefully this character gets to. You the moments you get and the reality that you get often is based on those small random things that happened and not the big decisions. A lot of us might have regrets about those. Gosh, I wish I hadn't moved across the country. But those things were conscious decisions, and that's different than sort of these small random acts that can change who you run into or where you go a particular day or all kinds of things. Somebody told me a story recently about how she was interviewing for a job, or supposed to interview for a job, and she got lost. This was back before people had GPS. But she got lost, and she couldn't find the place, so she just never went to the interview. And as it turned out, so she didn't get that job, but then she went down a completely different career path. And so it completely changed her life, the fact that she got lost and couldn't find the place that she was supposed to be. And I think those are the kinds of things that, like, and she's like, it turned out the way it was supposed to be because I ended up with a career that I absolutely love now. And it wouldn't have turned out that way, maybe, if she'd gone to the interview and taken that other job. I just think those things are fascinating.
They are fascinating. And now you mentioned how the book has been compared to Sliding Doors, and you as a writer have also been compared to Anna Quinlan and Anita Shreve. Mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome for any writer, but especially for a debut novelist.
Yes, yes, thank you. And those are authors that I admire. I really admire authors who can hit that sweet spot of telling a good story, a good plot-driven story that with a plot that makes sense and that you can follow and that doesn't throw a lot of red herrings in there, and have good character development. I think it's really hard to do both of those things, and the writers that I admire the most are able to do that. So I really, really like when you can see that in a story, that character development and how a character is transformed over time, but also with a page-turning plot, something that really happens.
So tell us about you. This is your debut novel. You have a what seems to be very successful career as a designer. Who are you, Cynthia Swanson?
Well, I've done a lot of freelance writing. My career is more in actually in writing than design. Design's more of a hobby for sure. But and it's a, completely a passion of mine. I was an architecture student for years. And I again, there's a choice. At a certain point when I was in college, I was an architecture student, and I thought I wanted to be an architect, but I kept going back to the English department and taking creative writing classes. And finally, I had a creative writing instructor who sat me down, and she said, I don't know if you really want to be an architect. I don't know anything about your design work, but I have to tell you, you're a great writer, so don't stop writing. And that did change things for me, and I really thought about that, and I ended up changing my major to English and becoming a writer. And so I always wrote fiction and published a lot of short fiction and always had a novel going. And I had a freelance writing career doing technical writing and some marketing. And then I kind of was working along with all of those things. I was working on the novel that I had going on. And I met my husband. And as I said, we got married really quickly, had kids really quickly. And creative writing just went right out the window. And I didn't do anything creative for years until I had the seed of this idea when my kids were 3 and 6. So that kind of changed things. And I still do freelance writing when I get a chance, when stuff falls in my lap. And the design is really, it's a very, very fun thing, but it's more of a passion. It's a side fun thing to do more than a career.
So how long did it take you to write this book?
I wrote a first draft fairly quickly, probably about 6 months, because I really stuck with it. At first, I was having a lot of trouble finding time to write. My kids were very young. My younger one was not in school at all. So and I was, you know, juggling some design work that we were doing on our house as well as some freelance jobs that I had coming in. So I really had no time to write. But I just found these little pockets, and I would write sometimes for only 15 minutes a day, but I wrote every single day. And I hammered out a first draft, and this was in the spring of about 5 years ago. And I got a first draft done before my little kids were done with school for the year. So I got that first draft done, and then I just sort of sat on it for over the summer and thought about it. And then once the kids were back in school in the fall, I got back at it. And it took about another year before I felt like I had a draft that was really ready to go or that I felt really good about. I was taking some writing classes at a writing organization we have here in Denver called Lighthouse Writers, which does conferences and workshops. So I was working with them a little bit and working with some editors there. I got to the point where I really felt like I had a pretty good, solid manuscript. But then it was another 6 months of polishing it before I was ready to put it in front of agents. So about 2 years altogether.
So now how does it feel to have this book out there in the world? And does it mean a change in career paths for you?
I hope so. I'm working on another one, and we'll see. I'm hoping that will be successful as well. It's also set in the 60s, although it's not in Denver. It's in mostly in New York, the suburbs of New York City, which is where I grew up. So we'll see. I would like that to happen, and I'm spending a lot of time trying to keep this book out in front of people. I go meet with book clubs, and I do a lot of readings, and try to get out there in front of people as much as I can and talk about the bookseller and about what I'm doing. So, yes, I would love it if this would be the career path that I would go down forever, but we'll see how it goes.
Do you think that there are, you know, certainly being a designer requires a lot of creativity. Do you see any parallels between doing that kind of work and writing a novel?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the biggest parallels between design and writing is that both jobs, creative writing I'm talking about specifically, require you to step into someone else's shoes. If you're a designer, you have to think about how a space is going to get used, how people are going to move about it, what they're going to be looking at visually as they do that, what's going to be clutter and what's going to be useful and what's going to be beautiful. And sort of the same way, when you're writing, you have to think about what's the clutter. And that often, I think, hangs up writers. I know it can hang me up sometimes, that you're writing along, you've got a first draft, and you've got an awful lot of stuff in there that actually ends up being clutter. And I tend to just, I keep going through a first draft. I just get it all in there. And then I know that there's going to be a lot of cuts. Some of that stuff I need to know in the back of my head, but it doesn't change the story. For instance, in this book, early on in the book, there was a whole scene about Kitty and Frida taking a big, long road trip across the country, which was kind of fun, and it's good for me to know that probably that was a bonding experience and it's something they did maybe in their 20s, but it wasn't relevant to the story. It ended up being clutter. So it helps me in the back of my mind to know it's there, but that doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be in the final book. And I think it's the same thing with when we look at design and we look at our spaces, is that it may be comforting to know that certain things are in your closet, but that doesn't mean they need to sit out on your coffee table all the time and get in the way. And it's kind of that same idea. So yeah, I think there is some relation.
I think that's really neat about that whole idea of cutting out the clutter and just sticking with the essentials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that helps tighten the plot. And it's extremely difficult to do on a first draft, and I don't try to do it on a first draft. On a first draft, I just get the story down, because I think if you get hung up on trying to write perfection in a first draft, you can really get stopped. You can just get so discouraged and say, I'm never going to have this perfect. You can't get every single page perfect. At least I can't. I mean, I'm sure there are people who write that way, but I don't. I can't get everything perfect. I have to just make a lot of notes. And sometimes when I was writing the first draft of the book, so there'd be times where I would just make a little note to myself that said, I have no idea what's going to happen here, and I'm going to move on now to chapter 7. and then later I would go back to it. After I'd finished that first draft, I'd go back, and it was completely obvious to me what should be there. I was, oh, of course, what needs to happen here is this. But if I had stopped there and said, I'm not going to go any further until I figure this out, I probably would have stopped there and never written the book.
Sure. Oh, I'm sure. You know what? It takes a lot of giving yourself permission to just write a lot of crap and not be perfect. And I think that as writers, we want it to be so perfect. We just want to get it right.
Right. Oh, I'm very much a perfectionist. I want it to be perfect, but I know myself well enough. And in some ways, I'm really glad I didn't publish a first novel. And I'm 50, and I'm really glad that I didn't do this when I was 25, because I there are some really hotshot 20-something and 30-something writers, and more power to them, but that would not have been me at that point. I didn't have the maturity to know how to do this at that point in my life. I think I had to have life experiences that taught me that, and that made it a little bit more, I got more accepting of myself and how I work than I would have been back then. I had a lot higher expectations of myself at that point than I do now. Now I know myself better, and I know what I can do and what I can't do.
But you still clearly have high expectations
for yourself.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, but I know that it takes a different kind of path to do them. So I don't think I would have written a fabulous first novel at 25. I thought when I was 25, I thought I was writing one. I'm glad my path turned out the way that it did.
Right, what we think we know at 25.
Mm-hmm, right.
So
some 25-year-olds know a lot.
That is true. You are right. So integritymodern.com is your website.
That's correct, yep.
So it's your website both for your business and for the book.
That's right, yep.
And people can use that site to reach out to you and find out more about you.
Absolutely.
And
there's a contact page on there. I also have event listings. Most of my events are around Colorado, but we will be traveling over the summer, and I'm doing a few appearances in the Midwest, so I would love to see people at any of those, and hopefully get out east at some point. As I said, I'm from there, so I still have family in New York, and I'd love to be able to get out there, so I will keep it up to date, so people can come back.
Oh, good. Sometimes I think that's the hardest job of that any author has, is to keep their website up to date.
It's true. Very true, yes.
And Cynthia, we need to wrap things up, but as far as the experience of reading The Bookseller, is there an experience you want your readers to have, or something you want them to close the book having felt?
I hope they feel satisfied. I hope they feel like they've read a good story, but also one that resonates with them and that maybe they can carry into thinking about their own lives and the choices that they've made and where the path that's taken them on, and hopefully finding contentment with those paths.
Cynthia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. This has been great.
We'll be giving away copies of all three of the books featured tonight. If you haven't already, sent us a tweet or an email to be in the running for The Bookseller, no worries. You've got until tomorrow, Tuesday, June 2nd, to reach out to us about wanting it or a copy of Laura Vandenberg's Find Me. Haven't heard of Find Me? Well, you're going to wish you already had a copy of it on your nightstand after hearing Laura and I talk about it.
It is my first novel. I'm the author of two collections of stories. One was published in 2009 and the other in 2013. So this is my first leap into the longer form. And the novel is narrated by a young woman named Joy, and it's set in the aftermath of an epidemic that destroys memory in a kind of near future America. And the book is divided into two parts. The first part is set entirely in a hospital in Kansas, and then the second part is set entirely on the road.
So where did the story come from, Laura?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's always a little tricky for me to pin that down. You might start working with different, you know, narrative elements. You don't really know where it's going to go. But it goes, it goes somewhere. But I really, I think it really started with Joy's voice with the first person book. And so there were certain, you know, images or lines or observations that became sort of lodged in my imagination. And so, I mean, I think her voice is what really drove the project forward.
So, but show us what that means. Like, were you just in the shower one day and someone said, "Hi, I'm Joy"?
Yeah, I think, lines do come. I mean, I think that the unconscious plays a huge role in any sort of arts practice. And sometimes, you know, when you're doing dishes or laundry or you're engaged in some sort of very mundane activity, and that is often when, you know, lines come to me. But the book has a very, very tiny little prologue of things I will never forget and then things other people will forget. This Joy, as I should have said before, is immune to this epidemic that destroys memory. And there's, you know, and there are two lists, and that's how the book opens. And those lists, came to me pretty early on. So that was, that's an example. But it often does come, you know, some not necessarily when I'm sitting down and working in a conscious way, but when I'm, you know, walking the dog or something like that, and these lines bubble up.
And do those lines that bubble up, do they often make it through all the revisions of the book?
Well, I wrote the first draft in 2008, and I wrote it in exactly the same way I've always written short stories, which is I write all the way through, I move very intuitively. And the first, the most important question for me to ask in a first draft is just why not? And to be as sort of like open and you know, risky as possible. And then as a result, with both with the novel and the stories, my process is really then taking that huge, messy first draft and sort of excavating the real story that's been trapped in there. And so rewriting, rethinking, restructuring, reimagining is, you know, 80% of the labor that I do. But with Find Me, you know, the thing that had happened, of course, because I had never written a novel before, is that, you know, to have a 300-page mess on your hands is very, very different than having, say, a 25-page mess on your hands.
Sure.
So I actually was so overwhelmed by what it was that I had wrought that I put the novel away for quite a while. And then, you know, I worked on it on and off for a lot of, you know, a number of years. But I think that there are a couple of things, probably a few lines, and the basic structure, the two-part structure that were in place in the final draft and in the final form, I'm sorry, the first draft and the final form of the book. But really, I think if you were to comb through the first version and the last version, I think you would find virtually nothing at, you know, the sentence level that carried over. So, which is to say the book evolved, you know, a tremendous amount over the years.
Sure, sure. Oh, my goodness. So when this book was released last year, it was released to all kinds of acclaim. Or actually, I'm sorry, when the book was released earlier this year, it was released to all kinds of acclaim. And it seems like that buzz is still really hanging on even several months later.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, no, that's kind of you to say. And I think I worked on the book for a long time, and I do think for all the sort of conscious decisions and craft at work and revising that writers do, there's still a part of me that feels, you know, when I send a book to my editor, it's kind of like here's this weird dream I had. I hope that there's someone out there who will be into this, which is to say, you know, you don't really know how a novel will be received by anyone until it's out in the world. And that's something that's, I think, a little bit different than novels and stories. You know, with this, my story collections, I mean, most of the stories were published in magazines before the collection was out. A couple had been anthologized. And so there is maybe, you don't know how the collection will read to people, but there is some sense of how individual stories have at least read to people in the past. But with a novel, like, it's really, you're just sort of going in kind of cold and blind in that sense. So just that, you know, that some people were into it was, you know, I was very excited and relieved, quite frankly.
So now, Joy works in a grocery store in Boston. Why Boston?
Yeah, well, I used to, I went to graduate school in Boston. I went to graduate school at Emerson, and I lived in Boston, and in Cambridge, on and off for, moving around to different parts of the city for about 3.5 years. And then for the last 2 years, my husband, Paul, and I have been living in Andover, Massachusetts. And so we've been in and out of the Boston area a lot. We got married in Harvard Square. And so we have a lot of roots in the area. And so it felt like, you know, it felt like kind of a natural setting in that way. And I think because I'd also, in addition to having never written a novel, this is the first thing that I've written, I would say, that's really sort of speculative or dystopian. And so I think it was very helpful to have the anchor of the familiar while moving into these new imaginative territories for me. And in the second part of the book, when Joy is on the road, she's also, her end point is Florida, and I'm from Florida. So for all the things in the world of the novel that are utterly unfamiliar to me, it was helpful to have those two landscapes kind of bookend the novel. I think that's probably has something to do with it.
And now I'm sure I'm not the first one to make the comment that it certainly has some parallels to Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11. Are you friends?
You know, actually, we are friendly. Yeah, we actually share the same agent. I've been joking that I've been joking with my agent, Catherine Fossett, who's fantastic, that, you know, between this book and Emily, and also she's also the agent of a writer named Benjamin Percy, who just released a dystopian novel called The Deadlands. And that Catherine is going to see nothing but dystopian submissions for some time, probably, and lots of, you know, plague novels. And I am friendly with Emily, and I think that she's a wonderful writer, and I think that that's a wonderful book. I do think that one thing that's important to say is that, you know, dystopian literature is really I mean, to me, it's a very, very wide umbrella term. And so, you know, in a very superficial way, this book bears some resemblance to Station Eleven, but really, if you were to read the two books alongside each other, not at all. I mean, Emily's book is very panoramic, and it's, you know, there you have a number of different narrators, and she's so incredible at these really elegant structures. And Find Me is a much more sort of, I think of it as a tunnel vision book because it is first person. And I think in a lot of ways, just the concerns of the books are very different. I think that that's the really interesting thing about just the dystopian landscape in general, that there's so many different shapes that can take, you know, Ben Marcus's The Flame Alphabet and Cormac McCarthy's The Road, but again, those are such radically different books.
Oh, I'll never forget The Road. That book just stayed with me.
Yeah, of course.
Terrifying.
Of course.
Terrifying in so many ways.
And, you know, think what a different novel that is from Station Eleven, you know, of course.
Oh, sure.
Even though they're both, have that kind of general label.
Well, I guess I'm just, you know, I'm thinking in part, too, about how, it's you have women protagonists. And,
certainly.
You know, even you think about The Blondes, right? The new novel by Emily Schultz.
Sure, yeah.
So there's another plague that's out there. And there's
Absolutely.
Another woman who kind of goes on a journey. I don't think I like all these plagues happening.
I know, yeah. And also, even in Lapucki's novel, California, which came out last year, too.
Yes, exactly.
And there's a new novel out, which I've not read, but I'm very excited to read, called The Only Ones, and it was published by $2 Radio, and it also concerns sort of a plague in a farther future America, and it's also narrated by a woman. So it's kind of interesting that, that not only that we're seeing the sort of dystopian trends, but also a lot of female protagonists.
Hmm. Well, we know women are just uber strong and are
right.
the ones who
We're
can overcome anything.
And
that's
yes,
right.
And that we would survive. And But I mean, certainly we're living. I mean, if you think about it again, I mean, I think that these things come in waves, and we certainly seem to be in the midst of a kind of dystopian cycle right now. But of course, you know, think back to The Handmaid's Tale and Margaret Atwood. And, I mean, dystopian literature, of course, does have a very long and rich, long and rich history. These are, you know, I think, incredibly anxious times, environmentally, politically, economically, and it makes sense that, you know, those anxieties would, you know, need to find a way to sort of take shape and manifest for writers.
Sure. And now I know you've had some great events for Find Me, and very soon you're going to be heading overseas.
Yeah, I am. I'm going, I will be overseas for much of the summer. I'm really excited to be a part of the London Short Story Festival in June, and also to be my story collection, The Isle of Youth, was published in the UK in March. So I will be doing an event for that and for the release of Find Me, which is so exciting and a real privilege. And then I am teaching in a summer program at the American Academy in Paris in July. So I'm really going to miss my dog, but otherwise I'm very, very excited for the summer.
That's amazing. I believe Leslie Jamison, who wrote the Empathy Exam, taught in that same program.
She did. Yes, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
And I remember talking with her about it, and it was just like all caps amazing.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. And, you know, if you're in Paris, it would be pretty hard for it to not be pretty cool. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So in many respects, I mean, you could say that you're living like the surreal writer's life. Is this how you imagined your life would be?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I grew up in Central Florida, and my family has always been very supportive of me being a writer. I started writing seriously in college, and, you know, I didn't get the reaction that sometimes people when they tell their parents they want to be a writer, like, you're going to starve to death, and why aren't you going to medical school, or anything like that. I mean, parents were very supportive. So at the same time, you know, at the same time, I didn't really, you know, there were no artists in our family. I didn't really know very many artists or writers growing up. So, I mean, I don't think I knew what to expect. And I think it's also really important to say that, I mean, there are ways in which one can sort of summarize, you know, one's life. Like, you know, I'm doing a book event in London and I'm going to Paris, where it sounds very surreal and very glamorous. But there's always a great deal of struggle and instability. I mean, just this, I mean, it's like as recently as, you know, a week ago, my husband and I were trying to sort out what we were going to do for healthcare the next year, for example. Thank God for Obamacare. Because he's leaving the job that provided us with our health. He's a writer as well. And, you know, and I'm working on a new project, and I'm every bit as sort of uncertain and flailing about as I was when, you know, I worked on Find Me. And so parts of it are glamorous and are surreal. I mean, I sort of can't ever get over seeing something that I wrote in a bookstore, and I want to be really nerdy and photograph it all the time, like just for myself, you know. And it means so much to me, and I'm so, so grateful. But I also wouldn't want to sort of misrepresent it as all being, you know, unicorns and rainbows. And there is always a lot of instability and a lot of uncertainty that goes with that beauty.
I want the unicorn and rainbows, Laura.
You know, unicorns and rainbows? Well,
you want the unicorn and rainbows? Come on.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But, you know, I think real life tends to only give us so many unicorns and rainbows, and I think if we have any at all, then we're pretty lucky.
I guess so. You are absolutely right. So what are you working on now? Can you tell us?
Yeah, sure. I'm working on a novel that is set in Cuba, and I'm also working on new short stories.
So you can do the two simultaneously?
Yeah, I actually like to do the two simultaneously. So I mentioned earlier that I published a short story collection called Isle of Youth in 2013. And I started, you know, after I'd written this crazy first draft to Find Me, and I put the book away for a while. And even when I was back in it and revising it, sometimes I would just get sort of burnt out and I would take breaks and write stories. And so I say that the Isle of Youth is really kind of accidental story collection in that regard. Like I thought, you know, this novel would be my second book. And that was just the thing that ended up getting finished sooner. So... I like to, if I need to sort of take a break from a longer project, I like to be able to turn towards stories.
Neat. So Find Me, what's your pitch for it? Why should someone consider going and picking it up?
I think to me, the thing that is the most, it's always hard to know what will interest people when it's sort of the world that you created. But I think of it as, I think in some ways, the kind of dystopian hook is sort of, it's like an aspect of the landscape, if that makes sense. And I really think that it's a book about memory and identity and self, and how selves can become sort of shattered and reformed in new shapes. And so I think if those things sound interesting to you as a reader, then it might just be up your alley. Also in the second part, which gets sort of progressively weirder and more surreal, there's a haunted house with underground tunnels. And so if that sounds exciting to you, then it might very well be up your alley.
Sounds wonderful. Laura, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Megan Abbott's The Fever has been nominated for several prestigious awards, including the Strand Critics Best Novel of the Year, International Thriller Writers Best Hardcover Novel of the Year, and the Folio Prize for Best Novel. It's also been chosen as one of the best books of 2014 by Amazon, Kirkus, LA Review of Books, the Boston Globe, Parade Magazine, the School Library Journal, and so many other organizations. There's also that MTV thing going on. No big deal to have the chance to adapt your best-selling novel into an MTV series, right? Wrong. Just thinking about that, in fact, made me have this correlation that Megan is a little bit of a literary rock star, don't you think?
It feels like a crush of good fortune, for sure. And, you know, as a writer, you know, there's so many ebbs and flows and ups and downs that, you know, you take what good fortune falls in your lap always.
So did you have any idea when you were writing The Fever, which I think is, what, your third book?
It's actually
no,
my seventh.
No, it's not. It's like
but in some way it is my third, because my last three have all been contemporary. My first four novels were all historical noir. So I consider these part of a sort of second series.
And did you have any idea when you were writing it that it was going to just get the kind of reception that it has?
No, I know. I knew that I was fascinated by the psychology behind it. You know, this notion of the sort of teen girls in groups and the contagious quality of emotion and the real life case that it was inspired by, which was a case in upstate New York. All of that fascinated me, and it seemed to fascinate other people too. So I just had this hope that if I could, you know, if I could frame the story in the right way and give characters that readers could connect to, that they might respond to it with the same enthusiasm I responded to the themes.
Well, I know, so you mentioned other people responding to that case. I know Catherine Howe wrote the book Conversion, mm-hmm. Which was based on that. You wrote The Fever. They're very, very different books.
They are. In fact, she and I are doing an event together next month to talk about that, about the different approach. You know, hers is a YA novel, and hers is... you know, definitely more inspired by kind of Salem witch trials. You know, she's from Salem area, witch trial feeling. So it's interesting that we were both, you know, motivated by the same real life case, but took it in different directions, which I think shows how there's still so much terrain in the area of teen girl psychology that's yet to be explored. There's so much turf there. There's so much that we've yet to uncover. So it feels like there's room for a lot of stories there.
Absolutely. So for those who aren't familiar yet with The Fever, tell me, what is it about?
It's basically the story of a family in a pretty small town, the Nashes. So the three points of view: the father, his teenage daughter, and his teenage son. And the best friend of the daughter experiences this really quite violent seizure in class, in school, in front of everybody. And it sort of unleashes this mysterious outbreak over a course of days. And then, you know, hysteria kind of results from that. And it's sort of in large part about the secrets that one keeps within families and within small towns, because all of that sort of comes to bear as well.
So were you thinking about a story like this before you read about the New York case?
Yeah, I had been. It was sort of like finally the vague idea I had met a structure or a kind of impetus. Because as a kid, I was really fascinated with cases like this. I was fascinated with Salem witch trials. You know, my parents took me to Salem when I was a kid, and we went. I don't know if you've ever been to the museum there.
Oh, many times.
Yes, it's incredible, and it scared me so much as a kid, because it's kind of very kitschy when you start, and everyone's making jokes, and then they do those live reenactments of the trials. And girl rolling around the floor, and it stuck in my brain forever. So I knew I didn't want to write about Salem because I was not sure how to do that without being Arthur Miller. You know? So I just wasn't quite sure. And then I guess the echoes of it in this case, the real life piece is quite different, but there's certainly beats that are similar. It sort of gave me an opportunity to explore some of these same themes, but in a different realm.
So the paperback version of Fever was released on May 12th. Was that as exciting for you or exciting in a different type of way as when the hardcover came out?
It is. And you know, we have a different cover for the paperback, which doesn't always happen, which is kind of striking, and so there's an element of it that feels new, and the TV news is just broken. So it feels like, you know, there's definitely I definitely feel a flurry of energy about it, which is kind of great, because sometimes that can sort of just be, sometimes you can almost forget when paperback's coming out, because you do so much touring and things like that for the hardcover. But this has been exciting, because it feels like there's a second life for the book, which is always great.
Sure, and now there's going to be a third life when it appears on TV, and I'm wondering how that's going. I mean, the first thought that I had was how wonderful that she can be involved, because so often authors lose control of how their story is then told in a different medium. How involved are you in bringing it to MTV?
I'll be writing the pilot, and then we'll see how if MTV continues to go forward with it, I would continue to go forward with it, which would be great. So it is not typical. It is really kind of great, because I have had different books of mine optioned, and then, you know, you don't have any role in it. In some way, it's a relief, because, you know, it's not my problem, you know. But in this case, it felt like sensitive material that I could, you know, delicate stuff, delicate psychology. You fear, and I don't fear this with MTV, but on some hands, you fear could be exploited. So I was really excited to get the chance and to write the pilot script for, you know, will enable us to sort of set up the world in a way that feels good to me and the producers and the network. So that's nice.
So, Megan, do you have screenwriting experience, or did you just say, you know, show me what I have to do and I'm going to figure it out?
I do have. I wrote the feature script for my previous book, Dare Me. So that was my crash course for Fox Studios. So movie scripts are a little different than TV, but at least it's in the same wheelhouse, you know. And it gave me an exciting adventure to rely more on the visual, to have a really compression of story, you know, sort of stretching different muscles, which was kind of great. And TV, I think, is kind of halfway in between, because you don't have to compress as you do for a movie, but you do have to make the world much bigger to give us places to go.
And how did you decide what to include in that pilot? Because, I mean, one of the things about TV shows that we all love and despise at the same time, if we're a fan, is that it always, you know, ends at that point where there's a sense of completion, but, oh my God, we need to find out what happens next.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's still to be seen, because I'm still working on it, but that is something that you think about a lot, and TV is really changing, and it's really become a place for, it's a sort of destination viewing now. So you really want it to matter. You don't want to disappoint your viewers. It's much more, you know, in a book, you write the book and you write the whole book without really anyone other than your editor reading it, and then it's out there, and then there's all this response. But TV is so much more iterative, right? You have an episode, and then there's the sort of roar of response, and, you know, and the recaps and analysis and everyone having opinions, and then you have to go back and keep writing. So it seems like it's much more interactive, and so as aware as I might be of a reader while I'm writing, I think when you're writing for TV, it's far more intensely, far more intensely aware of those viewers out there and how you can hook them and keep them hooked.
And writing for TV is hugely collaborative, whereas writing a novel, I mean, it's pretty much a solitary act.
Yeah, that's been the biggest adjustment, and it was with the feature too, is I'm used to being by myself and not having a lot of meetings and calls and then feedback, and, you know, the positive part of it, of course, is that these are all producers that know what they're doing, so, and know the TV landscape, and the network knows who their demographic is and what demographic they're trying to reach. So in some ways, it's you know, you're sort of on this big team together. I'm the one with the pen.
Oh my goodness. And it has to be a strong hand holding that pen.
Has working
on this TV project put your novel writing on hold?
It hasn't yet, though it inevitably will. It certainly did when I wrote the feature. But it is a lot of, like a lot of things in life, a lot of hurry up and wait, you know, because, you know, you have to do things quickly, and then you have this lull where, you know, people are reading it, and so then I sort of move back into the novel, and then, you know, so it's sort of it's a little bit schizophrenic, but it's definitely invigorating, and sometimes that can be good for the novel to take a little time away from it, and then you return to it, and you think, what was I thinking? This can't be like this, you know.
And so now you mentioned how you and Catherine Howe are going to be doing an event together that's going to be June 17th in New York City.
Yes.
Are you enjoying meeting and talking with fans, which I know you do not just in person, but online as well?
Yes. That's one of the things I really love about it's about touring, but also about social media, which is really, I mean, occasionally it's right, you know, occasionally someone will say something mean, but most of the time it's just such a positive experience, and it's great in a way that even when I first started, my first novel came out in 2005, and there was no Facebook, well, maybe there was, but I wasn't on it, Facebook then, and there certainly was no Twitter, and you just, you know, you would get emails maybe to the website, but that would really be it. And now you can meet people and immediately read the book and ask the questions and say things about it. And it's kind of great. And, it, you know, it's an isolating profession, so that it makes you feel like you know, you can always go to Twitter and all of a sudden the room is filled, you know, and that's a nice feeling.
That is a nice feeling, and certainly there is a great fandom out there for you, Megan. Is this how you imagined your writing life would become, that you would be part of really what's a bigger entity?
No, not at all. I am always surprised that anybody reads anything I write. I'm not sure what, I guess, you know, I'm a book lover from youth, obsessive reader. The one with the stack, or you're probably the same way with the stack of books by your bed, always. So it always seemed too fantastical to imagine that I'd get to do this for a living and that I get to talk about books all the time with people and get to meet some of my heroes. And so, you know, I got to meet Judy Blume last year. So that's kind of, I wouldn't have ever presumed to have guessed that. So I just feel lucky every day.
That's really amazing. It's, oh my goodness. And so are there any particular writers who have influenced you?
Yes, like so many, and then very different and odd corners. Certainly, Joyce Carol Oates was really big for me, and Sylvia Plath, certainly, and then on the, you know, I always read crime fiction, so James Ellroy was really big for me, and the old crime novels of Raymond Chandler, so it's sort of, you know, it's an odd mix in some ways. Shirley Jackson was always big for me. You know, sort of cross genres in that way too, you know, the gothic and crime and true crime. So I think that varied quality is maybe explains why sometimes my books seem to be hard, but they're exactly nowhere to put them. But I think that's increasingly the case. I think that, maybe we're post-genre in certain ways.
And Megan, can you read while you're writing?
I can, but I do tend to stop reading fiction when I'm past the halfway point in a new book. I'm worried that things will get stuck. I'm worried I'll pick up rhythms and, you know, from somebody else. And so I tend to turn to nonfiction, history, biography, true crime, during that latter half of the book, just to keep my head clear of, I don't want to do any unintentional plagiarism at all.
Sure. And now, will you be doing much touring or many events related to the paperback version of The Fever?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit around, you know, the next month or two, sort of scattered events here and there, which should be fun. I just came back from the Arkansas Book Festival, and so I'll be doing a little bit of that. I'll be making the rounds.
And so I'm assuming that your website, Megan Abbott, which is 2 B's 2 T's, .com, is the best place for people to go to find out what's going on and where you are and when we can watch The Fever on MTV?
Yes, absolutely.
That's great. And you know what, one of my favorite questions to kind of wrap things up is when people sit down to read The Fever, is there an ultimate purpose that you had, Megan? Is there something that you're really hoping that people are going to walk away from it having felt or experienced or seen?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, and this is, you know, this is sort of in the last couple of my book stops, like, particularly with The Fever, is that we're so still diminishing as a culture of the complexity and the ambiguity of being a teenage girl. And I think teenage girls, the sort of pressure on them to be a certain way is still so pronounced, you know, even among those of us who were teenage girls, there's such an American ideal about that. And so one of the things I keep thinking about when I write about teenage girls, and from the point of view of a parent of a teenage girl, is that how rich and complicated and unstereotypical real teenage girls are. They have passions and desires and aggressions and beauty all their own, and that's really important to me.
Megan, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Win a copy of The Fever by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. While you're doing that, I want to thank Megan, Laura, and Cynthia for taking the time to talk with me and be on tonight's show. We've been working hard on our blog and have some terrific photos there of authors with ties to New England who were at Book Expo America in New York City last week, including Alice Hoffman, Jodi Picou, Gregory Maguire, Lev Grossman, and so many others. So please check it all out. You can find our blog at www.litnewengland.com. And I hope you'll come back often. I hope you'll also come back here next Monday when we'll give away books and air author interviews. We'll be talking about Bittersweet, Contrition, and Mind of Winter next Monday. So we hope you'll be back with us. Until then, have a great week and great reading.